Hello and welcome to another episode of the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News. In this episode, we'll be discussing therapeutic and medically guided experiences for terminally ill individuals involving a range of drugs such as psychedelics and other substances. We'll sit down with palliative and psychedelic care physician Dr. Michael Fracken, who will talk about patient safety and ethical considerations and the therapeutic evolutions taking place at the end of life. Michael is a board president of the Institute for Rural Psychedelic Care and palliative care physician at the Humboldt Center for New Growth. Michael is also a clinical advisor at Divine Journeys and the physician liaison for the traditional healers and natural helpers for the Hoopa Valley Tribe in California. He has previously served in medical director and palliative care consultation roles. Additionally, Michael co-founded Resolution Care, which launched in 2014 and provides virtual and in-home palliative care and symptom management. The company was acquired in 2021 and rebranded as Vinca Care in 2022. Before we begin, Hospice News has a brief update to share. If listeners have subscribed to our podcast directly through SoundCloud, we've made a recent change to our infrastructure that could affect your subscription. We apologize for the inconvenience and encourage you to subscribe through a podcast player such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And now, let's begin our journey into today's topic. Hospice News is so glad to have Dr. Michael Fracken with us for our podcast today. All right. Well, first, Michael, why don't you give us a general overview of your experience as a palliative care clinician and what drew you to that field and as well as to the kind of psychedelic end-of-life care realm?
Yeah, thank you, Holly. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. I am a palliative care provider. I've been doing this work for 30-plus years. I've built a hospital-based consultation program. I built a program embedded in our cancer program. And then I built a home-based program taking advantage of some of the magic of video conferencing called Resolution Care. Subsequently, that was purchased by a company called Vinca. They continue doing that work. Palliative care for me has been this long, gentle transition to being interested in the people with the illnesses and their experience, and less interested so much in the technical biomedical detail of what's wrong with them. I'm kind of interested in who they are and how they're navigating serious illness and approaching death. The psychedelic piece is all about that. Human beings are complex. Our biological, biomedical worldview that we take for granted in the global north and Western medical science looks powerfully at just a portion of the human experience. And despite providing fantastic, almost miraculous technological fixes to problems that people have medically, human beings still suffer. Mm-hmm. As human beings, within families, within their own historical trauma, within their dreams, realized and not realized in life. And it's that part of the human being that has always drawn me from the bedside up to build programs. Psychedelics really point at that part of the human experience. We'll talk more about that as we get further, but my own interests, to be honest and a little bit out of the closet about it, have come from my own experiences. Recognizing from those experiences the healing potential of this kind of work.
Yeah. That ability to kind of address the whole scope of, symptoms, the emotional psychosocial, that spiritual journey at the end of life. Yeah.
Even more, I would centralize the spirituality piece. I've sat in rooms around many tables with chaplains that generally hold their hands close and don't necessarily feel invited to talk about the core issues of the human experience, despite the value that they bring to teams. And it's only in hospice teams and palliative care teams that they have any voice at all. This work is really centralized around the issues of spirituality. Of course, that have all these implications for the experience of physical symptoms, for the management of the psychosocial challenges, for the modulation of all the emotional elements of the experience. But this is really work that is core at the spirituality piece.
Exactly. It's part of, you know, that end of life experience and part of who we are as beings. So I think that what I've seen a lot more just anecdotally and more, I've heard from hospice providers and palliative care providers that there are patients that are seeking these therapeutic and medically guided experiences that involve substances that are, you know, federally controlled, things like cannabis, ketamine, you know, MDMA, psychedelics, and all of these kinds of different drugs. So I think that what comes up when you're talking about something like that is really how you've seen these experiences kind of evolve among, you know, patients that are serious and terminally ill, and what that means as providers too. So I think as we dive into these conversations, the first question really that I wanted to ask you, Michael, was how you've seen those therapeutic experiences evolve among people who are, you know, taking part in them, especially in more recent years.
Yeah. I promise you I'll answer the question, but first I want to say something.
Sure.
Never, ever before in Western medical healthcare delivery, modern medicine, in the global north, have we ever intentionally induced a non-ordinary experience of consciousness with the intent to heal? We have induced a ton of non-ordinary experiences of consciousness, but as a side effect, an unintended and maybe undesired side effect of lots of stuff we do on behalf of people. But never before have we done it intentionally to invite a healing process to occur. Now, that being said, all around us, for many thousands of years, in traditional and indigenous communities, inducing a non-ordinary state of consciousness with healing intent has been at the core of everything that they've done, whether through ritual, through ceremonies, through shifting of attention and magic tricks of a shaman. That is the core of these traditional wisdom medicinal interventions. That's the foundation we stand on as it relates to healing. And through trance and dance and even the use of plants, these indigenous societies have gathered wisdom carefully and thoughtfully on what it actually means to invite healing to occur, especially when you can't change the outcome from a disease or an illness or an injury that's going to take a life. So the wisdom to do this work actually does not exist within our healthcare system, and we need to kind of start from that place of humility. This is brand new. I don't even think we understand quite what we mean when we talk about healing the whole person or healing in the days and weeks and months prior to a person dying. It's different than therapeutic interventions. It's different than controlling symptoms. It speaks to Cicely Saunders' concept of total pain when she talks about all the 360 degrees of integrated self and whole self that can manifest as social problems, behavioral problems, symptom control problems, all manner of drama that we see for lots of folks as they finish their life. So in terms of, is it evolving, these therapeutic experiences with psychedelics? Yes, it's evolving. We're learning. We'd like to think about this time in history from this point of view as a psychedelic renaissance, or maybe even better, a reemergence of psychedelic interest, much of which has been driven by refreshed and renewed activity in the clinical trial space, in the drug development space, but also in the public sphere, with things like Michael Pollan's book and Netflix series, How to Change Your Mind. There's a lot of conversation about this. And so the answer is yes, it's evolving. And people from the regular cohort of referrals around palliative care and around hospice services are speaking about it a little bit more. In fact, I don't know the data on how many folks above the age of, say, 40 or 50 have had some psychedelic experience for themselves, but it is not an insubstantial amount of people that have a visceral understanding of what this is, and maybe even an indication or a hint of how potentially beneficial it can be for healing.
And I think that you're bringing up this interesting point, though, is how that healing is defined, right? And I think that that's kind of part of the next question, which is, you know, what challenges, what are the common challenges that you are experience when you do kind of navigate this realm of using these kinds of substances, and what that means as far as, you know, what challenges providers experience, and also the people, you know, going through those experiences, the patients, right? So I guess this is a twofold question for you as far as, you know, where maybe that healing fits into those common challenges and what you would define as those common challenges that are associated with, you know, using these guided experiences.
There are all of the sort of obvious challenges for something new and sort of unformed as a part of the Western medical model, and that maybe don't fit so easily within the Western medical model. There's legal issues related to each individual substance, each individual constituency and states and regions. There's financial issues. There are costs to this to participating in this work, even where it is legal. And then there are, you know, like everything else, places where there's a lot of availability and places that are more of a psychedelic desert, if you will. For example, in Oregon and in Colorado, they have these emerging state-based programs that allow for legal, therapeutic, and even just developmental work with these medicines. So in the state of Oregon, you can engage with a reasonably vetted facilitator in a site that's been vetted and take psilocybin in mushroom form that's been biochemically analyzed and accountable as good material. In Colorado, it's a broader program and a little earlier in their development of how they're doing it. But there are places you can go in the U.S., and have legal experiences with psychedelics, whether in the context of illness or not. There is a proliferation of ketamine-assisted therapy with a whole range of unregulated access available to it, but it still has costs to it. And because it's an unregulated space, we don't even have a certification body that determines that this person is adequately trained and this person is not. We don't know what to do with all the people who have the most experience in our society doing this work very, very well, because they've been doing it for the last 20 or 30 years underground. And that includes a whole bunch of people, not just hippie, groovy healers, but also professionals that have quietly assumed a risk of doing this work because they were sure that they were confident that it was beneficial for people, and they took the risk of doing that work from the underground perspective. So we don't have a regulatory body. We don't have expectations or standards about what's really good work and what's really terrible work. We've got a wide variety of people who claim to have reasonable expertise and capacity to facilitate, but no way for people to reliably kind of navigate that. So that's a huge challenge. There's three or four different ways that people engage with these medicines. One of them, probably the most common, is for fun. Recreationally, people have mostly safely engaged with these substances and sometimes with real significant personal benefit from them, just for the fun of it. We don't know what to do with that in our society. Fun is a scary concept, I think, recreational use, despite that being the most common. There are spiritual organizations, religious organizations, churches, some of which have achieved legal legitimacy and approval from the DEA to practice their religion utilizing psychedelic substances or plants. And then there's this very, very new world of kind of unformed infrastructure to provide safe therapeutic experiences within the clinical domain of work. And so it's very variable. That's a huge challenge. My experience with my clinical experience with safe and legal and accountable ketamine-assisted therapy is wonderful, extraordinary. I can't tell you how blown away I've been at the impact, the positive impact on people and their families. While they struggle with mortality and the sort of existential loss and grief that comes with finishing a life. But the biggest challenges really are related to variability and the unregulated space.
Yeah, it's defining what eligibility, what quality, what program integrity, to your point, the resources of, you know, having trained professionals who understand the risks and the potential benefits, but, you know, and walking, you know, patients and their families through all of that. It's a lot of unknowns. There's more research, right, that I've noticed pop up that's examining all of this. But to your point, it really does matter in where it's being examined. And in one pocket of the country, it's not as much as the other. So I think that really takes us to the heart of a lot of our conversation today, which is how do we define that safe, ethical utilization? I mean, what are those considerations when we're talking about these drugs, such as psychedelics, such as cannabis, and that kind of thing? What is your approach maybe to those ethical considerations? What you think mm-hmm. they should be, you know, overall for anyone who's kind of helping a patient navigate these experiences?
Well, it fits in pretty well with my sense of responsibility around dealing with vulnerable folks that has been taught to me by those vulnerable folks over 30 years of doing hospice and palliative medicine. The respect that one has to have and maintain in caring for people who are at their maximum vulnerability already before you give them a consciousness-altering substance, that raises the bar an order of magnitude on this long, mistake-ridden pathway of learning how do you take responsibility for the power that you have in the therapeutic relationship. Hospice and palliative care professionals tend to address that directly. They address it with the power of the team. So they're rarely working in a vacuum, and they're often getting multiple perspectives as they work with their interprofessional teams. But there are some pretty unique issues around psychedelic substances. There are issues around ego. I think if there was, if I had a magic wand and could add a universal quality to all the psychedelic experience, it would be that it would diminish our tendency towards egoism, narcissism, thinking that we are in some way special. The work to do that as a hospice and palliative care physician, male physician in our society, has been fraught with lots of learning to get to a place of like, this is really not about me, right? These medicines, unfortunately, intend to elevate a person's sense of specialness. And so that's a very unique kind of quality. So transference, that when you take a vulnerable person and make them even more vulnerable, they might look to you like you're the one that saves them. And so the transference issues are really real. And navigating that from a sense of responsibility, accountability, and respect for I and thou is critically challenging and difficult. And then if you want to make it even more complex, issues around many of the domains within a person become kind of more morphic and change and shift. And one of them is sexuality. And our society, in dealing with emerging issues of sexuality within a safe structure, we make all kinds of mistakes when you look at the society at large. So issues around sexuality, transference, attachment, guruism, egoism, narcissism, those kind of can emerge in these spaces. And working in a responsible way is not for the faint of heart. You have to have structures and systems around you that ensure that you stay respectful of people and don't impose your own agenda on them. We know a little bit more about that in hospice and palliative medicine than maybe elsewhere in our society. But I got to say, all those issues, psychedelics turn them up to 11.
Yeah. And I think it's being aware of that too, of knowing that you are caring, to your point, for a vulnerable patient population who's at this, you know, end of life, who has potentially, you know, existential distress with facing the end of life. I don't know how you couldn't, most people, you know, you're right with the end of your life. And that's what I think has been some of the common uses for that, is addressing that as existential distress. And to your point earlier, you know, navigating those spiritual components of it in line with someone's beliefs and their culture and how they view death. So I think those are key ethical considerations to kind of put into that spot. But if you had sort of this, you know, best practices playbook that you would like to develop for hospice, you know, and palliative care clinicians as they're helping to navigate that safe, ethical utilization of things like cannabis or other substances or psychedelics, you know, what would you say should be included in that best practices playbook for providers?
Well, first of all, what I want to do is I'm going to separate cannabis out. Not because it's not a potentially useful plant-based medicine with some consciousness-altering capacity. It is. But it's also its own sort of sociologic phenomena. And it lives in, at least in my state, where it's legal, in the state of California. It lives sort of in the realm of substances that people use to enjoy intoxication. It's got its own culture. It's got its own thing. It's not unrelated, but I'd like to separate it out for purposes of talking about psychedelics, drugs, medicines that are used specifically to induce a non-ordinary state of consciousness for healing, right? So let's separate that out. And then on the playbook, I think
practices playbook to separate. Step one, separate.
Separate is clarify what we're talking about, right? But I think what the listeners today and what you can kind of hear in my voice, the word humility, the recognition that this is new, and responsibility in the management of the vulnerable is really where I would probably start in my intro. And then I would, you know, what hospices have become incredibly expert at evaluating and trying new and different kinds of things under the umbrella of hospice. And there are training programs and individuals that have certifications. I have my own little certification. I did a year-long program and trained up with a bunch of PowerPoint presentations and everything else. But I think it's much better if hospices have interest in exploring this work. They need to build collaborative relationships with people who've dedicated themselves to making themselves responsible and accountable for the work. It's much more subtle than it might seem after absorbing a bunch of PowerPoint presentations about the pharmacology of ketamine, the theories of psychotherapy, and a few models. I think that people are used to, in professional training, doing a bunch of workshops, taking a bunch of courses, checking a few boxes, and then feeling like they're stepping into a space that they can have confidence in, and they get in over their head. The weirdest thing, I think, about highly effective psychedelic facilitators, in contrast to the typical way we train folks in healthcare, that probably the most important feature of people who are highly effective is that they have done their own deep, personal, psychological, psycho-spiritual work. With medicines, maybe, in some cases, or with therapists, or with meditation and mindfulness, whatever it is, it's the personal work that you do that gives you the best kind of solid foundation for doing this work. So my advice to hospices that have an interest in this work is, well, reach out to me if you want, and I'll help you by utilizing my networks to get you connected, but partner with agencies and individual providers that you recognize as doing highly safe, thoughtful, and responsible work. We, for example, in our community have a contract with Hospice of Humboldt. They send folks over referrals for existential distress or sometimes just some assistance in using ketamine as an adjuvant analgesic. I have good experience with that and have spared a lot of people a lot of side effects from opioids from that. We have a contract with our community PACE program. We have a contract with the Hoopa Valley Tribe, one of the Native American communities in our region. And we have a contract with the Veterans Regional Clinic that's based here in Humboldt County, so that those vets don't have to go down to the city and back to get access to ketamine-assisted therapy. So collaborate with humility and be discerning to make sure that you're not talking to people who are just trying to make a deal, but that you're talking to people who really are showing up to the unique qualities of this kind of work. It'll be clearer over time as we develop some of those regulatory guardrails in the space. It'll be clear who's vetted as a highly responsible, accountable provider. But for the time being, it's not the kind of skill set that you can just add on by doing a couple of workshops. I'm a part of and one of the founders of a Google group called a Palliative Care Psychedelic Google group. And we launched it about a year and a half, 2 years ago. We now have 900 professionals in the end-of-life space, in the psychedelic space, that have an interest in the intersection between end-of-life work, palliative care work, and psychedelic work. And it is a robust forum and network for people to share ideas, tell stories, introduce different kind of training programs, and really think deeply about this work. That's a community that I really am proud of. There's an organization called the End of Life Psychedelic Care Organization, EOLPC, that's doing this work. If you have an interest in doing this work, reach out to me and I'll try to help you caveat emptor, find your way in your own region or area to providers that at least I think are coming at it in the right way, in a good way.
Well, I think that there are some opportunities here to kind of discuss as far as, you know, opportunities on the horizon when it comes to psychedelics and end-of-life care delivery. I wanted to kind of give you more of a chance to highlight efforts that are taking place now to kind of improve what we've been talking about here today, which is safe and ethical utilization. What are some of those opportunities that are on the horizon?
It's amazing. I won't make too much comment about the current changes in the sort of government support and policy. It's just too complex and fraught from Washington, D.C. these days. But there are some indications that things are going to be moving along. It appears to be by the end of this next year, we'll probably have psilocybin approved in some fashion for use. One of the couple of different psilocybin, one or both of the psilocybin clinical trial drivers, USONA Institute and Compass Pathways. We might even see some correction around the hiccup that occurred for MDMA and its approval for PTSD. We may see that also advance in the next year or so. There's a lot of research on ibogaine for addiction to opiates as well as PTSD treatment. And then there's a whole world of phase two trials that are showing real positive findings around end-of-life work, but also more general in the mental health for many other substances. There are currently, according to Google AI, 800 active clinical trials in psychedelic medicine right now. That's a big deal. There are my little tiny institute, the Institute for Rural Psychedelic Care and the EOLPC. There are at least 12, maybe I think at least 24, two dozen academic research institutes that have emerged, Harvard, Nebraska, all kinds of different places around the country that are consolidating efforts and running more than one trial and running educational programs. There's an organization called UPEP that's teaching faculty how to introduce this early in the curriculum for nurses, social workers, therapists, and physicians. There's the philanthropic efforts. The Psychedelic Science Funders Collaborative has been very important in driving early investments in clinical trial development, as well as infrastructure development, some support for community-based organizations doing things. But then there's this really remarkable grant program called Healing Hearts, Changing Minds. It's a philanthropist desire to make a difference in the space that I call home, where end of life, palliative care, and psychedelic care overlap. Better than $500,000 in investment in projects in communities, diversity of projects in communities around the country. They'll be announcing the recipients of those awards later in the month, maybe about the same time that this podcast comes out. But they signify a lot of interest in continuing to look at this as a different than normal kind of initiative. inspired by kindness, compassion, and responsibility and safety.
Yeah, and I think that these are opportunities to highlight, just to see, you know, what that intersection between psychedelics, drugs, and end-of-life care and palliation is going to be. So thank you, Michael, for kind of sharing your time, your perspective today. Do you have any kind of final thoughts that you'd like to give our Hospice News Elevate podcast listeners?
I am so grateful to be a part of my professional community. Nurses and social workers and chaplains and nurses' aides and fellow physicians and nurse practitioners and all of us that are moving towards people at the end of life while most everybody is moving the other direction. I have found a home in this community and done various different things over time. But as I sit here in my 63-year-old body, I just feel grateful that I have this community to feel a part of.
We're grateful to have your perspective too. So thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this Elevate podcast. A few quick notes before we sign off. One more reminder to be aware of potential changes if you subscribe to our Elevate podcast through SoundCloud, which we apologize for and encourage you to now subscribe through a podcast player such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Also, Hospice News podcasts are possible thanks to those in the field willing to share their insights. Let us know if you or others are interested in participating or sponsoring an upcoming podcast by reaching out to us at editor@hospicenews.com. Once again, I'm Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News, a WTWH media company. Thanks for listening to today's Elevate podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes. Take care for now.